Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Many of us have long awaited our chance to have our very own Star Trek replicator.
I believe it's a molecular synthesizer of some kind, similar to a protein resequencer, but far more advanced to water, cold. I saw a similar device in a Tarkalian vessel. It was capable of replicating almost any inanimate object.
If we had one of these in engineering, we could make all the spare parts we need.
That's a scene from Star Trek Enterprise. But a new book by the Gershenfeld brothers is taking a serious look at the promises and consequences of a world where anyone can turn data into things and things into data, as they write. And they call this future, where anyone can make almost anything, the third digital revolution after communication and computing. The book is called Designing Reality, How to Survive and Thrive in the Third Digital Revolution. And we're joined now in the studio by the Gershenfeld brothers. First of all, Neil Gershenfeld. He's the director of the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT. He's known for his global network of fab labs, those makerspaces all over the world with tools like 3D printers, for community use. Neil Gershenfeld, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld. He's a professor at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University and past president of the Labor and Employment Relations Association. Welcome to you as well.
And I should note,
indeed,
we spiritually brought our brother Alan, who's here in spirit.
Exactly. And he's co-founder and president of Eline Media, right?
Right.
Okay.
He developed the biggest video game studio,
yeah,
and then left to do games for education and social change.
So you guys are like the dream team then in thinking about all aspects of what you're calling this third digital revolution.
Yeah. You could think of Neil being science, me being social science, and Alan being the humanities.
Okay. So first of all, let's just get some lay a foundation here. How close do you think we are to this third digital revolution, and will it look like a Star Trek replicator?
Oh, I'd say we're as close as it started, depending on how you counted, 10 years ago in 1952 or 4 billion years ago. But it's very much present today.
Wow.
And so the book is a bold prediction about the present. The best way to understand that is the digital revolution in communication and computation followed what's called Moore's Law, this amazing,
yeah,
projection. He based it on Gordon Moore, founder of Intel, based it on 5 data points of the number of transistors on a chip. And on a linear graph, it's just a few points. But if you take the logarithm, which measures doubling, they line up. And he said, what if it kept going for a decade,
mm-hmm,
and it went for 50 years?
Yeah.
The heart of this book is digital fabrication. If you make the same graph, we're about 10 years into it. So we're further than Moore's Law in being able to make that prediction. So
already,
it's here today. It's just not uniformly distributed.
Okay. So tell me more then about how, once we get more uniform distribution, how is it going to look? How will it change our lives?
So if you have a makerspace or a fab lab in your community, you're already experiencing people collaborating to design and make things. There's about 1,200 fab labs in the world and a similar number of makerspaces. So they're out there and people are seeing it if they have direct contact. If not, it seems abstract or distant. But as Neil says, the doubling of fab labs and the doubling of the capability of the technology is increasing. And the question that we're asking is, what happens to society if this continues? With the first two digital revolutions, we fell short on things like access, inclusion, and all the weaponized social media.
Right.
And so now we're saying, with the third time around, maybe we can get it right early on.
Well, so this is really important, and forgive me for going back to a Star Trek analogy here, because it's something I can see in my head here. But I think we tend to do this with technological revolutions, right? At first, there's this utopian rush of all that is possible, and even on Star Trek, like, really, when I think of a replicator, I just think of Captain Picard making his Earl Grey tea. I don't also think, at the same time, that exact same machine allows, because they never show it, someone to replicate a weapon instantaneously. We don't think of the potential downsides.
Yeah, so I think it would help to understand when I say it's here today is, like, there was originally the first single mainframe, and then there were maybe 1,000 mini computers, and then 1 million hobbyist computers, and then 1 billion smartphones, and then 1 trillion Internet of Things. So think about how computing went through those stages. You could already see all of that at the 1,000 stage. It got faster, better, cheaper, but mm-hmm. fundamentally really didn't change. In the same way, in the book, we explain how to go from one fab lab to 1,000 to 1,000,000 to 1,000,000,000 to 1,000,000,000,000. And so my lab is on the hook to deliver the replicator as a research project, but the internet wasn't invented after the iPhone. It was decades before, and that's the point. You can do it all today. And so the questions Joel's raising about access, literacy, education, what is work, what is money, they're really here today, but we don't have to wait 50 years to figure out we got it wrong.
Okay, so your concern isn't so much about the potential uses of the technology itself, but what you were talking about earlier, who is and who doesn't get to use it in the coming years.
So, of course, we need to mitigate harm with any technology. And the idea of bad people doing bad things with technology is always a concern. But even before we get to those issues or concurrent with those issues are even more basic questions of not having a digital divide get even worse if it's tied to the ability to make things. What's at stake here is literally people owning the means of production, communities able to break global supply chains and make more of what they need locally in a way that can transform communities. And it can be good and bad depending on the choices we make now.
And if I could pick up on that, sort of the defining battles right now of this era revolve around nationalism versus globalism, sort of roughly. And underneath that is inequality, unemployment, all of those issues. To a really great extent, that whole spectrum is a false dichotomy that's sort of missing the point. It's assuming, do we bring back the old jobs or do we create new jobs? But rather than getting a job to get money to then buy something made far away, if you can create what you consume, mm-hmm. it really changes what is work and what is money. And so when I'm at gatherings of like captains of industry and heads of state, they're all sort of depressed because nothing's working.
Right.
When you're in these communities sort of inventing this third digital revolution, they're excited because they're really changing notions of sustainability and empowerment of community.
Of sustainability? But okay.
Because rather than... for example, a colleague became the city architect of Barcelona. Great design sense there, 50% youth unemployment. Whole generation can't leave home and work traditionally. But products come in made far away and trash trucks go to trash dumps. So he considers the city a product to trash conversion device.
I see. Yeah.
What they want to do is have data come and go, but the atoms stay. So they're filling the city with the means of digital fabrication as part of urban infrastructure so that if you live there, you can produce what you consume as part of the sustainability, the viability of the city.
When you sort of put it in those terms, I can see how it could be create a more sustainable future. But perhaps I'm just a bit cynic about human nature. I also think that if I'm able to create anything I want with relative ease, I'm going to overcreate and overconsume.
So that's really what brought Alan and I into the book. Neil is a technology leader and is on this 50-year journey to the Star Trek replicator. Alan and I have...
What Joel didn't say is Neil is slightly misguided and needs some mid-course correction.
We call him a techno-optimist.
Yeah.
We decided that in many respects, we believe Neil is right, that the technology path is unfolding, but we didn't trust Neil alone to get it right. And so in a sense, Alan, with his focus on humanist issues around his work is with Games for Change, but it's all about social change. My work is similarly, but coming at it from the point of view of governance and institutions and society, we're basically saying that we have the chance to take into account, as you say, the dark side of human nature and build those assumptions into the way we interact with the technology now.
Yeah. So let me ask you, because you mentioned something earlier that I didn't dig into deeply enough, and that is that the first two digital revolutions, as you describe in the book, created, because we didn't manage them perhaps in the smartest way, created inequities, certain inequities. So those are challenges we have to face right now. Does this third digital revolution perhaps could it have the negative consequences of creating a negative feedback loop that even makes even more inequities? And I'm thinking just at the sort of a rudimentary example, like schools, elementary schools now that are able to afford creating makerspaces versus those schools that cannot because there's already inequities built in.
So let me give you an example. You're absolutely right that a deeper digital divide is one of the risks that we face. But let's take the region Pittsburgh. It was a steel town that fell on hard times. About 10 years ago, there was a series of pancake breakfasts that educators said kids aren't learning the way they used to. And they started focusing on project-based learning. One breakfast led to another. It led to 17. Today, 10 years later, there's 2,000 educators, about 200 makerspaces and fab labs, and they're really reinventing learning for that whole region. And it's become a center for robotics that's tied to Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh. But it starts in the elementary schools, the middle schools, and the high schools, in which they're saying, leave nobody out.
To pick up on two reasons why we wrote the book to have that discussion, but why it's reasonable to be optimistic. One is fab labs can now make fab labs. So rather than being limited than buying one, the technology really is growing to be able to spread virally. And in turn with them, they're being used today to make food, furniture, all the sorts of things you consume. There's a Fab City movement that Boston, Somerville, and Cambridge joined of cities committing to a countdown to producing what they consume locally. And so rather than sort of big companies far away doing mysterious things that lead to inequality, they're being used for the sort of meeting local needs. And that's why this one is so different, because think of it as what we're doing is we're taking the digital world, but we're sort of bringing it out here into the physical world.
Okay, so I mean, I'm coming around to your way of thinking, but I do wonder though, haven't we seen in the past that anytime exciting new distributive kinds of technologies, at first it does seem like it's going to bring so much more into the realm of individual or local control and creation. That's what it seems like at first. But inevitably, governments and corporations somehow end up consolidating what was once distributed. And so, why won't that happen in this case?
So on the one hand, we don't want to paint government and corporations all with the same paintbrush. There are plenty of companies and plenty of government leaders who are genuinely motivated by double bottom lines and so on. So there's plenty of room for public-private partnership and for innovation that involves the private sector as well as the public sector. But you're absolutely right that we have not done a good job of building in the institutions that co-evolve with technology the first two times around. And there's a lot of work to be done to not have it come up short as it could. So your skepticism is well placed, and we have a lot of work to do.
But the part I think you're not right about, again, what's different is a user of Facebook doesn't have much control over what Facebook does. Mm-hmm. There aren't easy points of control here. I've been in rooms with the military heads and the intelligence heads where half of the room wants to control it, and the other half points out what I would say, which is there aren't points of control. You can help shape it, but there isn't a bottleneck for somebody from above to take it away. Again, go back to this image of fab labs making fab labs, local production. There aren't sort of points of control for central authority over it.
Okay.
I'll reinforce what Neil's saying. Again, we have entered this project to say, can we make sure that we take into account all of these social challenges? But if you look at the ecosystem of fab labs, people are sharing designs independent of trying to protect intellectual property. They're sharing the underlying principles of the materials they use, which is often a closely guarded secret in industry. So there's a sense of openness and sharing. It could be shut down by certain forces, but right now it's getting out faster and in a sense seeping through cracks in the system and creating some norms that allow for that local control.
We have just a couple of seconds left, less than a minute, actually, but I want to get one more question into you, because it seems like as if this fabrication revolution really requires internet infrastructure. But speaking of the now, again, we just have a couple of seconds, the FCC has this different stance on net neutrality. What effect might that have?
So again, this doesn't replace, it merges communication computation with fabrication. Okay. One of the most interesting projects is people making their own internets, bypassing the FCC.
We'll have to have you back to talk about that. Well, we just scratched the surface here, but it's an absolutely fascinating book. The book is called Designing Reality, How to Survive and Thrive in the Third Digital Revolution. It's by Neil Gershenfeld, Alan Gershenfeld, and Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Indeed, a pleasure.
Our pleasure.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.